Hi, I'm comedian Eliza Skinner. Welcome to On the Podium.
Where the hard work never stops, or at least it never stops for Olympic and Paralympians that we have on. I take breaks. Including our own Scout Bassett, para-athlete and world record holder. Make me feel better. Scout, sometimes you struggle to get out of bed, right? You're not always ready to go.
Oh, absolutely. Just like probably preparing for a show, you're not always at 100%, you know. that certainly is the case for many days of training. In fact, I don't know if this is common or not, but I feel like there are more days where I don't feel great, or there's always something going on, right? There's a lingering this or a nagging this, than the days where I just feel amazing and I'm so excited and operating at 100%. I think just at this level and you do it enough and for as long, those days are pretty rare, but when you get those days, it just makes it that much more satisfying.
Yeah, but I mean, you start pretty early, right? Like, my shows are at night. I got all day to pull myself together.
I don't know if that's worse or not. Like, when the races are at night, sometimes that's hard because you rarely train at night. And just keeping yourself energized and alert and fueling you, you know, before a night race can in itself be a challenge. So it works both ways.
Okay, I'll take your word for it. The BBC's Ed Harry is also here. Ed, are you an early riser or a night owl?
I'm really good at early.
What? Wow. How?
Well, we know from he likes to arrive at the airport at like 3 a.m. Remember?
Sorry, we'll let you talk.
I know.
Yeah. I can do early. So if I've got to get on a bus to go to a stadium, or if I'm on a shift at work where the first commitment on air is at this time, that's fine. What I don't like is more like a 9-to-5 structure. I don't like that sort of wake up at 7:30 to be somewhere for 9. I'm much happier waking up at 5:30 to be somewhere for 7, or just getting up at 10.
See, I think my big issue is I love a leisurely morning, or like a wake up and like slowly make coffee, hang out with the dog. I need like 3-4 hours to wake up. And I hate having to start that at 5.
If someone says, I need you on air at this time, that'll be okay, won't it? You say, of course it will. That's why you sent me here in the first place. And then you've got to make sure the kit's switched on, the kit works. You open your mouth and words come out that are obviously amazing words, or the best you can manage at sort of a very early hour of your morning.
Yeah. When I was in college, I had a radio show at 3 a.m. and I remember going to that in my pajamas all the time. I would carry my little records across campus in my flannel pajamas. Be like, this is as close to being awake as I can get. Time we got on with the show and introduced our guest. Ed, who's on the podium?
Joining us is a 4-time world champion and a 4-time Paralympic silver medalist in the long jump. He's also a world record holder in his classification, which is for athletes with a visual impairment. Our guest is blind, and he has been since childhood. His first Paralympic Games was Athens in 2004. At his most recent World Championship in 2019, he produced the furthest jump in that competition's history. He is Lex Gillette. Lex, welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
We're so excited you're here. We've actually found some photos from your social media and just of you. And we're going to use those to guide the conversation. Ed, what's our first photo?
Well, our first image is usually our guest's greatest sporting achievement. The thing is with Lex, there are many moments to choose from, lots of different candidates. So what we've gone for, Lex, is the podium moment at the Doha World Athletics Championships in 2015. And this is all three medalists from the long jump. It's that moment after you've just all got your medals and they all step up onto the top step and join you. So you're in the middle with the gold around your neck. And I guess we chose this one because you'd been world champion once 2 years before. This is the first time you defended your title. Was that any different to come back no longer a first-time winner, but someone who made it 2 in a row?
I actually thought you had pulled that picture up because that was the World Championships where I had ran and jumped and landed on the side of the long jump pit. So
we'll get to that. I remember that. Yes.
But yeah, I mean, it was definitely a great time. And I don't know, I mean, that competition was pretty meaningful to me for a lot of reasons, and specifically what I had mentioned earlier about landing on the side of the pit. So yeah, that's a special moment.
I think, shall we, before we go any further, there will be people, I'm sure, listening who wonder, I've just introduced you, I've told people you're blind, and yet you are a long jumper, and you don't do this by yourself, you've got a sighted guide. So why not explain to us exactly how you and your guide get you from standing at the top of the long jump runway to you getting in the sand and registering a mark, and usually in your case, a winning mark? What exactly do you both do?
Absolutely. So my guide, he'll physically walk me to the start mark. And my start mark is usually around 35 meters away from the takeoff point. So he's positioning me in the middle of the runway to make sure that I'm in the right spot, make sure that I'm pointed in the right direction. Certainly don't want to run the opposite way. And he will then go down to the takeoff board. From there, he's letting me know if I need to turn my shoulders to the right or to the left. And once I'm repositioned correctly, then he'll start to clap and yell, "Fly, fly, fly, fly," as loud as he can. So that gives me the audible reference, the auditory cues. And from there, it's me listening to his voice, counting my strides. And it takes me 16. On the 16th stride, that's when I jump. And of course, it's something we practice it daily. So at this point, it's a lot of muscle memory.
Lex, your relationship, your connection and bond with your guide is probably one of the most important parts of you being able to be a jumper. So can you tell us a little bit about how long you've been working with Wes, and how do you develop that kind of trust? Because he really is your eyes, and I think a lot of people just assume you pair up with somebody and you're, you know, out there doing it, but it's quite a process.
Yeah. When I started in 2004, I've literally only had three guides. So I had my guide who introduced me to the sport when I was in high school. I had my second guide was Jerome Avery. And I worked with Jerome from 2004 to 2007, actually. And then from there, it's been Wesley and I working together. And that's, golly, it's almost, 14 years. So I always tell people I want to know what the average length of a marriage is in America, because I know that we gotta be winning right now. 14 years of working together.
I think you've surpassed that.
Let's name check him again. Wesley Williams, part of this great partnership that you guys have. I'm wondering, does Wesley get a medal as well, or is that something that's only happened in more recent years?
You know what? They just do it on the sprinting side. So I need to start lobbying for them to start giving the long jump callers medals as well, because they definitely, they're there. And even though he's just calling me in the long jump when we're training and throughout the season, he's there running the hills with me or running on the track or helping me do my drills or in the weight room or whatever it is. So he's definitely just as much a part of the process, which, yeah, we should definitely give them medals too.
Lex, let's actually go back to Doha and that competition. And we all saw that unfortunate jump where you did not land in the pit. Can you walk us through what that felt like, and just paint a picture for people that wouldn't know how to be in a position like that?
Yeah, I remember it was echoing inside of the stadium where the long jump pit was situated. It was right next to the stands, so there's this barrier. And when you're yelling or clapping or making any sort of noise, it creates this echoing type of sound. And then when you couple that with just random noise or crowd noise that may be happening inside of the stadium, when I had ran and jumped, I remember for a split second, I felt my body shift to the right-hand side a bit. And for that one moment of time, I was like, all right, you can either abort mission now, or you can land this jump. And that was only because my mindset was, all right, this is a gold medal is on the line, world championship is on the line. I'm just going to ride it out and see what happens. I ended up hitting the ground, and it definitely, how did it feel? Yeah, it hurt. I think the adrenaline and the energy and the excitement of the competition carried me through the duration of it. So I went to the medical tent and was able to get cleaned up. I had bruised my elbow, gashed my elbow, and had ripped my tights and things like that. So had to get another pair of tights too, because didn't want to moan the crowd or anything like that.
I assume there's rules about that too.
Yeah, somewhere.
So after you get your new tights and you receive your treatment, sometimes when you know you take a bad fall or something happens that is painful or unexpected, did you have a moment of doubt or of fear, or should I hold back on your next approach?
Yeah, I think that the natural feeling for a lot of us when we experience those things is to definitely, like, you coil up and you retreat a bit. I think at that time, since I knew just the intensity of that moment, I thought about how I didn't want that to be the last image of what people saw of me and saw as an athlete. Well, I certainly felt embarrassed and felt like that shamefulness, if you will, because I've been doing it for so long. And that wasn't the first time that has happened, but it was the first time that has happened on that stage. But ultimately, I just wanted to make sure Wesley was cool, because he was the one that could actually see what was going on. And I know that his intentions are not to get me hurt. And just wanted to reassure him, like, hey, man, this is a team effort at the end of the day. You know, my trust isn't severed because of this situation. This is what happened. This is what I'm hearing when I'm standing down here. So let's figure out a way to adapt and adust and make sure that this make sure that this next one, when I run down here and jump, I'm gonna feel some sand beneath my butt.
But it had to make that gold medal even a bit sweeter, right? Knowing that what had just happened and that you were able to pull that off after, you know, such an unfortunate incident.
Yeah, it felt good. That felt, being standing on the podium and receiving that medal felt way better than those showers a week at, like, the next few days after.
I bet.
Now, you've been on this podium so many times. Is it like no big deal at this point? Or are you like, this whole thing?
No, I wouldn't say it's not a big deal. I think that each moment that you have to go to a major international competition, each one is like its own chapter. Even though I've been on the podium multiple times, it certainly never gets old. And when I'm training and thinking about those opportunities, I literally just try to train as if I'm still that 16, 17-year-old kid who literally just found out about the sport, and you're really hungry at that time. You really want it. And if I can keep that same type of tenacity, then I think it, number one, kind of keeps you humble and kind of taps into that idea of, like, okay, well, just because you win doesn't mean that you can't get knocked off. You just got to keep working and not assume that your talents are going to carry you to the top all of the time.
Well, let's see what our next photo is. Ed, what do we got?
Oh, man.
It's okay. This is a picture of childhood. Lex, this is a photograph of you graduating preschool, something that we don't really celebrate here in the United Kingdom where I am. But I think this is wonderful. And having seen this, I wish that we would. You're dressed in a white cap and gown.
Okay.
You've got thick spectacles on.
Yep.
The teacher, she's also wearing a white dress, and she's leaning down to shake your hand. And this fascinates me because this is obviously a visual memory for you. You still had your sight at this stage. I mean, how vivid a memory is this day and this moment?
You know what? That day in particular, I can't say that it was that I totally could sit back and say, oh, I really remember that. But when you talk about the time of when I was able to see, certainly I have a lot of memories of when I had eyesight, and around that time I was, I would say, figuring out life, right? Like figuring out yourself and just figuring out how to just maneuver and think and learn and just having an awesome time.
So you mentioned your eyesight deterioration. How long of a process was that?
It was, excuse me, I would say it was pretty long. I started having issues with my sight when I was probably 7 and had come home from school one day and went through my normal routine, played outside with friends, video games, etc. And that night I was in the bathroom getting myself cleaned up, getting ready for bed, and that's when I first noticed that something was different. So looking at my hands, they were looking blurry, and I remember just that weird, eerie type of like ghost-like image of hands and the lights and the ceiling. And then I get out of the tub and look into the mirror, and now I see this very disfigured reflection that, you know, you're supposed to see a very crisp, clear image of yourself when you look in the mirror. The next morning, everything still was looking blurred and faint. So we went to the doctor after an examination. That's when they saw that I had retina detachments. From there, it was on and popping. It was literally me inside of the operating room, go home. You're at home for 3 to 4 weeks. You're going through that healing process. I could see clearly for those 3 to 4 weeks. After that time, sight would get blurry again, go back to the doctor, go through another examination, reveals another retina detachment, and then we go into the operating room again to fix that. So it was in and out of the hospital, in and out of the hospital for the entire time that I was 8 years old. And that year alone, I had 10 operations.
Wow.
To try to fix the issue.
That's a ton of operations for anybody, especially an 8-year-old.
Yeah. And after the last one, it was, you know, the doctors basically said they couldn't do anything else. And they said that I would eventually become blind.
I'm wondering, are you, as an 8-year-old boy or 8, 9, 10, are you angry or are you just rolling with this? What is the overriding emotion for you as your sight is slowly being taken from you?
I think the biggest thing was just the uncertainty and not really knowing what was next. And so after that last operation, I still was able to see. So it wasn't a total, the lights are on and then the lights are off. It was a gradual decrease. And I would go to sleep at night each morning, wake up, seeing a little less than what you do the day before until one day you wake up and that's when you're not able to see anything. So that's when it, you know, like reality, it hits you in the chest and you come to the realization that you're not able to see anything at all. And I think at first when the doctors had mentioned it, it was like, all right, I'm not going to be able to play Super Mario Brothers anymore. Like, am I going to be able
kid
to
priorities
right watch TV? Am I going to be able to draw and ride my bicycle, all of those types of things? And then when it finally actually happens, that's when you come to the realization that, all right, well, I'm not able to see my mom anymore. I'm not able to see the neighborhood where I grew up and all of these things that you're so used to, you know, seeing and experiencing. But I wouldn't say there was anger. I would definitely say there was overwhelming sadness and uncertainty. And I'm going to say it took a year or two to truly get through that grieving process of, all right, this is life. And I did spend those days where I would sit around and would have my head down and you know, your mind stays in this space where you're like 8, 9 years old and I'm going out into the public and people ask questions, oh, what happened and what's wrong with your eyes and all of those things, they don't really make you feel good.
Yeah, I mean, just imagining that kid with his head in his hands, like just imagining what your mom must have been going through, that I mean, that must have been tearing her apart. Like, how do I help this kid in this journey that we don't know about?
Yeah. Yeah, my mama's a go-getter, though. She's like, I mean, she's a, like, no excuses, don't, like, not, doesn't play games. And that's not the, that's not to make her sound like she's, you know, like the big bad wolf or anything like that. But I think that she had a perfect balance of being able to show that love, to also challenge me, to push me. And really, she wasn't a self-pity type of person. It was, all right, I need to show you what you need to know so that when you go out into the world, you'll be able to be self-sufficient and be independent and survive on your own, because you're living in a new experience. This is a different experience. And a lot of the people in the world probably won't understand you or understand the things that you go through. And a lot of people out there may not even want to understand, but I want to make sure that you know what you can do so that you decide what you can do and not have to depend on someone else to decide for you.
So from going, you know, through that process to, did you go to regular school then after you had lost your vision, or did you go to a school for the blind, and where did sport enter that picture?
When I truly healed from all of the operations, I did return to school, and my mom kept me in public school. And she felt like that would be the best decision for me. Not that there's anything wrong with going to a school for the blind or a specialized, you know, specialized school, but she wanted me to continue to learn and participate alongside my sighted peers. And I think that, you know, it certainly helped a lot. Made a lot of friends and had a lot of fun growing up in school. When I got into high school, though, that is when I really got into sports seriously. And I found out about track and field through one of my teachers. We had this physical fitness test that we had to participate in one day. And it's one of those tests where you have to do as many pull-ups as you can do, as many push-ups and sit-ups.
The presidential physical fitness test.
Is that what it's called?
Oh, man. I hated that thing. Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Girls had to do the flexed arm hang, and boys got to do pull-ups and such weird tests. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so we had that test that Eliza obviously hates. And and so one of the activities was standing long jump, and I was really good at standing long jump. So from there, I had a teacher who, he knew about the Paralympics, and that's another thing that I really think is like special and fortunate, because that some people find out about Paralympics when they're young, some people find out about it when they're mid-20s, and some of them may find out about it late to mid-30s. And so I feel like I was definitely fortunate in the sense that I found out about Paralympic sport when I was 14 years old. And from there, I had someone to give me that guidance, and Mr. Whitmer, who he started off as my teacher of the visually impaired. So since I stayed in public school, I did have someone that was there to help me. He made sure I had everything that I would need from an accessibility standpoint. So all of my books were in Braille. I had computers with speech software on them. So he was responsible for making sure I had all of those things so that my academic experience would be good, because that my mom was number one was academics on her list. So none of the sports or anything like that was going to happen if I had bad grades. So Mr. Whitmer made sure I had all of those things. But when it came to athletics, he also created this environment for me where he said, oh, you know, this is the Paralympics, and this is the highest pinnacle competition in the world for athletes who have a disability, and you can potentially go here and represent Team USA and win medals and break records. And from there, it was him developing a plan and us figuring out how we were going to train and the strategy by which I jump, learning all of those things. So, yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty big question, but in the time that you've been in para sport, your first Paralympic Games was in 2004. How much do you believe it's changed and grown? And as far as you're concerned, how much more does it need to change and to grow?
Oh, man. Yeah, geez. I didn't really know until I stepped inside of the stadium. That's a moment that I'll never forget, that you step inside of the stadium and you immediately, as someone who can't see anything, you feel the electricity there's so many people inside of the stands, and you feel the heat from all of the bright lights, and you hear the crowd yelling and they're screaming and represent our countries. And so thinking about that moment all the way to 2021, it's changed drastically. And I think that the awareness certainly is picking up. And particularly when we went to London in 2012, out of the four games that I've been to, that was my favorite one. And the reason being is because the exposure and the awareness of Paralympic sport is absolutely incredible in that space. And I thought it was very interesting that when I was competing there, when I was done with competition, my next line of action was finding food. So we went over to, what mall was it?
There's one called Westfield. Yeah.
Westfield?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one that adjoins the park. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was getting stopped in the mall. Like, oh, we just saw you win your medal. And people wanted to take photos, and people knew, and they were engaged, and they were aware of what happened. And so thinking about that type of experience, we don't have that here in the United States. We don't have that yet. But I think that with Los Angeles coming up in 2028, I really think that it's an opportunity for all of us to help and increase that awareness and to help shift mindsets. And I think that in LA, we're going to put on an amazing show, and that'll be the explosion that really shows the American people, like, hey, these aren't just athletes out here who are just, oh, you know, or we found something to do, and you know, we're just out here training, da 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 da. Like, these are literally athletes. You know what I'm saying? Like, these are literally athletes putting on amazing performances, athletes who are ridiculously, insanely talented at their craft. And not only that, some of them have families, some of them have kids, some of them have full-time jobs. They're literally living a similar experience as the next person. So I'm excited to see what's going to happen with that over the next 6 years in the U.S.
Yes. So you mentioned LA 28, and one of the coolest things that I think has been happening is they have started so early engaging Paralympic athletes and Paralympians. There's sort of this long runway, right, that they have to promote the Paralympics leading up to the Games. And it'll be the first Paralympic Games in LA. So I'm curious, you know, this is not live, but do you have intentions of
competing in LA?
Competing then?
I am...
No pressure here, by the way.
I mean, the question has come up a lot. I told myself that I would go until Paris. And selfishly, prior to 2024 being announced, LA was going for 2024. So in my head, I was like, yeah, all right, come on now. Let's get 2024, and that'll be the absolute perfect way to close the curtain. And I can leave my shoes on the track, and that'll be a great walk off into the sunset. But unfortunately, it didn't happen that way. And I'm gonna go to Paris, and from there we'll see how it all plays out.
Okay. But either way, you're gonna be a tremendous ambassador for those games, no matter what.
I'll be there in some capacity. Yeah, I can promise that.
Well, we're looking forward to that for sure, too.
Definitely.
In terms of the Paralympics, Lex, we mentioned right at the top, you've won the world title four times. You're the world record holder. But on the finals day at the Paralympic Games, four silvers. How much is that still a motivation that the Games, I'm not saying it owes you a gold, but I would suggest that of all the things you still want, that must be top of the list, right?
Nah, definitely. I mean, obviously, if you go to the games, you want to get on the podium and you want to win gold. And unfortunately, that hasn't happened yet. But it doesn't deter me from continuing to go after it. I think that that's a huge aspect of us being able to excel in life is to continue to persevere, right? So when things don't go the way you want them, then you keep going. And I you know, each games has been different, but ultimately I can walk away from each of those and say that I did everything that I could do in the time that I was given. And so I don't have any regrets on that at all. But come Tokyo, oh man, yeah, we got some work to do for sure.
This is On the Podium with me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. Our guest today is the blind Paralympic long jumper, Lex Gillette. Ed, do we have another photo?
This is a photo worth the wait, okay? Because this is Lex Gillette at the White House, and I believe it wasn't the first time you visited the White House to visit the President of the United States, but this one is 2016. There is a lineup of Team USA athletes, and you're speaking in this picture to President Obama. Now, like I said, I don't think it's the first time you went to the White House, but even to be in that position, to have your achievements recognized by your country and in these moments to be shaking that man's hand, I mean, how special is that, Lex?
It's really special. It was really special. And it's especially with Obama being in the White House. And yeah, I mean, everybody has their political views, et cetera. But I think just excluding politics, just to be in the presence of him, he's just like really cool, kind of laid back. You hear him in the interviews and things like that. He just has a certain type of swag to him. So to be in that space, it's wild. I thought you were actually going to pull up the picture from, now I'm trying to pull up more pictures, but there was a picture from 2012, and I had took a picture with Michelle Obama, because when I took the picture with Michelle Obama, we were literally hugged up, this is my auntie that I hadn't seen, you know, like in a couple weeks, so.
So what other kind of stuff has popped up along the way? What other kind of things other opportunities besides just competition has this career given you?
It's got me opportunities like this to share the story and to help promote the movement. It has taken me to so many different countries and taken me into rooms and spaces and introduced me to people that I would have never imagined. And, you know, doing things like throwing out first pitches or, you know, singing at you know, sports games. Or
you sing at sports games? Oh,
I actually wanted to bring that up because one of the talents that if people don't know is that you are a phenomenal singer. I mean, we won't make you sing for us here, but at least I'm not going to ask. But like, what are your musical inspirations, or when you do sing, what are the kind of, like, where does that come from?
Like, I was tinkering around with keyboards and things like that before I had lost my sight. I eventually picked it back up when I had gotten into college and had been playing and singing. And that ultimately just became another avenue to be able to communicate with people. I felt for a long time that I just wasn't being, I wouldn't say being recognized, but a lot of conversations could happen and I could just fall between the cracks and no one really noticed I was there. But I was like, you know what? Music is, that's like the ultimate connector. Music and sport, two of the most powerful things that really connects us all as human beings. It doesn't really matter where you come from or your background, your culture, what you speak or whatnot. If people, you know, see a sport or they hear music, it's kind of like we begin to speak the same language. And so I said, well, let me continue on this path and it'll be another way that I can just express my feelings and really get messages out there into the world. So in a perfect world, which is evolving, I've definitely recorded a lot of stuff, but I told myself that in the lead up to getting into Tokyo, of course that goal was kind of derailed a little bit with last year, but the goal is to literally put out a full length project. So I am going to work on that, and that'll just be something special you have to wait for.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Looking at you you strike me, Lex, as a like a truly rounded guy. You've got not only the main reason we're talking to you is everything you've done in long jumping, but you've sprinted too. You've triple jumped as well. So we're talking about you because of your track and field achievements. But you talk about your music, you talk about your public speaking, and all these other projects you're involved in. Not so long ago in this program, you were saying, you know, when I started to lose my sight, I was saying to myself, can I still play video games? Can I still do this? Can I still draw? I mean, what would you go back and say to the 8-year-old you who maybe was feeling uncertain and bewildered at the big change that was about to happen to him? Because from where I'm sitting, I think it turned out pretty good.
I would say to him to, you know, get out and explore and to discover and try as many things as possible. I know we probably hear that a lot, but the reason we hear it a lot is because it's true. I would tell that kid to definitely keep pushing to try new things. And for the kid who specifically is visually impaired or blind, I think a lot of it revolves around my mantra, which is no need for sight when you have a vision. And so that basically, at the end of the day, it's not relative solely to someone who's blind or visually impaired. I think that it relates to everyone, because it's not our sight that determines our success. It's that ability to see a vision and do everything in your power to bring it into fruition, because you see it within yourself. You see it within the world, within others, before it actually becomes something you can touch and see with your eyes and feel with your hands. And that's literally what gives you hope in times of despair.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us. This has been really fun, and we are definitely pulling for you in these games and in life in general.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Eliza, Scout, Ed, definitely.
May this fifth one be the golden one for you.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. All the best to you, too.
Oh, he was super fun.
Gosh, amazing. Just what a great storyteller, and just so articulate. He's thorough and yet motivational all in one, but he never comes across as overly rehearsed, even though I know he's shared his story and journey on many platforms and many stages before. Truly one of the very best, and just as an athlete and as a person, and a big face for Paralympics, for sure.
And what he does to be blind and to be long jumping, I think there are times we talk about the Paralympics being parallel to the Olympics, but there are other things in the Paralympics that you simply wouldn't get in an Olympic Games, which I think are different and better and to be celebrated as something you're just not going to get anywhere else. And this whole idea that the sighted guide, you know, Wesley Williams and he have been together, what, since 2007? Wesley straddles the area where Lex takes off. So if there's anything wrong with the calling, if Wesley is still standing there when Lex runs to take off, they're going to bash straight into each other. And you see this over and over again. Someone is full speed sprinting. The guide is guiding and calling, and then they just deftly step aside.
So they're in front of the jump?
They're straddling right over the point at which you take off. So as they call, Lex is coming directly towards Wesley, and right at the last minute, Wesley will step out of the way.
I was imagining him like at the other end of the pitch, like really yelling, like, come all the way down here. Oh. So it's a real dance.
There is. And it's a real partnership. But I think I know when people succeed, they say, I'd like to thank, and they rhyme people off. But the way he talked about his mother not standing for any nonsense, the way he talked about finding and developing trust with Wesley, the way he talked about Mr. Whitmer at school. I mean, there is luck in all these stories, isn't there? You know, Mr. Whitmer just happened to be somebody who knew about the Paralympics, who then with Lex kind of worked out, how could we get Lex to there one day?
And what a brave and bold move by his mom to choose for him to go to regular public school, because here in the States, that's really not all that common. Most of the kids that are blind or visually impaired go to a specialized schools, and just the fact that his mom said no, he's gonna go to a regular school, and I think that's partly why it's afforded him some of the opportunities he's had. Because let's be honest, I don't know if, you know, 20 years ago, if he had gone to a school for the blind, that he would have found Paralympics, A, and B, him being immersed into mainstream education and schooling. I think that's partly why he's so independent now. You know, he's learned how to navigate that world, and I think that's a great lesson. You know, he's even just shared for, you know, so many parents that all the time come to me, or, you know, how do I get my kids immersed into able-bodied sports, or should I only put them in Paralympic sports or sports with other kids with disabilities? And I think it's really, really important that, you know, young children with disabilities learn to navigate. And, you know, at a certain point in life, you know, you're going to get outside of that bubble, right? And you have to learn how to function and how to be with people that don't look like you and don't have your same struggles. And he's done that really well.
Well, and I think that that's such a, you know, you maybe you don't have to have a specialized school, and you don't have to have specialized teachers. Any teacher can be the kind of teacher that's like, hey, I got to make sure this person is just as involved despite whatever his physical differences or limitations. I think a lot of people are like, oh, well, that's for someone else with a whole degree, a whole set of expertise. And it's like, no, you don't really need that. I mean, sometimes.
Yeah, it's an argument that it's something gets revisited a lot here in the United Kingdom, because there are certainly, we've got stars of para sport who say a more separate schooling structure has actually helped identify talent better before. I think it's about, if you're going to go into an integrated environment, you need a few more Mr. Whitmers on the staff. You need people who can truly integrate everybody, because if you find yourself at a, in inverted commas, mainstream school and it isn't catering to your needs, a number of years ago, I made a documentary about Tatiana McFadden. You'll know her well, Scout, this incredible wheelchair racer. You know, she wasn't allowed to participate in school sports, so they took the school to court, and this escalated, and it's become a Tatiana's law, adopted by states. More and more states have adopted this as a law, that you cannot exclude children from sport. If you want to join the track team and you're a wheelchair user, you can join the track team. No one's saying, no, you're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that. And I think Lex has demonstrated, hasn't he, in that integrated environment with the correct support, look what, and not just what he's done, what he's still doing and what he might still go on to do. And if, you know, he's a physically fit guy, he's in his mid-30s, keep everything crossed that the injury doesn't sort of cast a shadow at any point, you know, he could be there in 2028 for a home Paralympic Games.
That's it from us. You can head online and see the photos we've been talking about. Just search for BBC Podium. Next time, Scout Bassett, Ed Harry, and myself, Eliza Skinner, will be joined up on the podium by another very special guest.
Many parents came to me. There is a very proud moment for me that I'm a very big inspiration for the Indian girls. So many thinking is changed that a girl also can do bigger things.
The full story of Indian Olympic medalist Sakshi Malik, that's next time on The Podium.